This is that the thing that metta practice points to, that loving kindness practice points to, is that you can connect with this feeling of easy loving. And as you practice loving all sorts of, you know, creatures and trees and people and fractious kittens and all the rest, you find that you can, the list just grows longer and longer, right? And then you hear other people's, and it's, there's just mudita, just a delight. Like, oh, you love all the dogs. Like, yeah. And the toddlers. And, you know, and I was riffing on this a bit in the meditation, the way that the quality of loving kindness that, you know, is invoked in metta practice. You know, one of the core metaphors given is, or similes, I always want to say metaphor, but they're all similes. One of the core similes given is maternal. You know, the line in the Metta Sutta, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. And so there's this sense of metta being protective, but also having that kind of, you know, unconditional or impartial, really unconditional is the quality there in that line, a kind of unconditional acceptance and love. And then it's a mystery, you know, to figure out how to cultivate that quality of, you know, powerful, unshakable, you know, kind of glorious maternal, you know, acceptance and love, and to separate that from the personal connection to, you know, one's own baby or one's own dog or one's own child, one's dear friends, and figure out how to shine that quality impartially on everything. And so, you know, as Kimberly, as you were saying, like, really making this a daily practice of adoring, you know, everything that's adorable in the world. And then bit by bit, you know, it just feels so much better to adore things than to complain about them. You can start to adore things that aren't even all that adorable, because they, because they're doing the best they can, you know? And so, a love that can cut through story, that sees through all the stories, you know, story or narrative, like story is really the thing that stops love. Right, a story that something shouldn't be loved or can't be loved or is unlovable, that, you know, a certain person is doing too much evil for me to love them. There's all sorts of people that are doing too much evil for me to like them. But from a comfortable meditative distance, I can totally shine loving acceptance in their direction. And I'm not going to vote for them, and I'm not going to give them money, and I'm not going to, you know, get in a relationship with them. But I can see that it's just better for my own sanity to like fly, you know, below the clouds of story or above, whatever direction the metaphor wants to be for you, and just shine this quality, you know. So. blessings to the great the great quality of loving kindness, of metta. All right. I'm writing the monthly newsletter article on the Brahma Viharas on loving kindness right now for Spirit Rock. So get the newsletter on Saturday, and that'll be my little essay in the metta section. So I've been thinking about metta and reading suttas, and it's just really a delight. All right, so, but the topic du jour is not just how easy things are to love. The topic du jour is karma, the great troublesome theory. I'm gonna say a little bit about just a basic overview of how the Pali Canon talks about karma. Kama is the Pali term. And then just a few of the reflections that that I think we can fruitfully chew on around this this theory. The word kama literally means action. It really means action that has consequences. And in the early Buddhist formulation, kama is really actions that have results that determine the future in kind of important ways. So not all actions generate karmic force, or if they do, you know, they generate relatively mild karmic force. Like the action that you did this morning of choosing what to have for breakfast, like maybe it has a little karmic force, but not a huge amount of karmic force, you know. Unless what you did to get breakfast was, you know, poach a chicken from your neighbor's yard, and then you're a thief, and you'll have to bear the consequences of that. A noble profession, poaching. My kid and I just reread Danny the Champion of the World, which is just one of the most glorious kid books, I have to say. So, poaching. But, you know, don't steal if you don't want to create the karma of that. Karmic actions are actions that determine our situation in the future. So they classically are, charged ethical actions are the ones to really pay attention to. And so the list of disciplines we call the precepts, not to kill or take life, not to steal or take that which isn't offered, not to commit sexual misconduct, or if you're in a celibate situation, to observe that celibacy, not to use speech that is untrue, harsh, untimely, or unkind, and not to misuse intoxicants that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. These are the five classic lay precepts or ethical guidelines. And they point to five realms of action that have karmic results. So, you know, if you misuse intoxicants in a way that causes you to act in a way that hurts others, to act heedlessly, you'll feel the results of that, right? And they will as well, you know. The results could really ripple out from that, depending on your circumstances. If you lie or use speech that's harsh, you know, the folks you use that language to feel the result of that, and you feel it, you know. If you commit sexual misconduct or steal or take life, you'll feel the result of that. And all of those, and they're all relational, right? So they all have to do with not just you feeling the result, but there's a result that impacts others, other sentient beings, human or animal. There's an impact on others. So karmically potent actions are ethically charged, and they're generally relational. They're really about how we live with others in a complex world. The Buddha admitted that karma was complex, because there's a couple layers in, you know, what causes a given result. One of those layers is intention. So in the early Buddhist texts, it is the intention that causes the karmic result, particularly for oneself. So this crosses into the contemporary discourse of intention and impact. But the classical formulation is that an action that causes harm, but that was a mistake or was done without a harmful intention, that doesn't have as strong a karmic impact on oneself as if one had the intention to cause harm. The contemporary discourse on intention and impact really focuses on the impact. So whatever your intention was, you can do something that has a harmful or painful impact on others, and it's appropriate to take responsibility for that, to be accountable for that, because you care. But it's still different to have had the intention to cause harm versus the intention not to and to make a mistake. It's a lot easier to feel okay about yourself if you made a mistake than if you were actually hateful in your heart, right? That just hurts more. It has a longer effect in your own life. And I think that if we don't take them too literally, these doctrines that, you know, intention is what creates karma, and the contemporary justice doctrine of intention and impact, they're not actually in conflict as much as they might seem. As long as we understand what it means for something to have karmic impact. And what it really means is that it determines our own state of being in the future. So state of being could mean my emotional state in the near term, or states of regret that I might have in the long term. Or classically, it might mean states that are so powerful that they haunt me in such a way that they determine my next rebirth, right? So in the Christian sense, this would be determine my path to heaven or hell. In the Buddhist sense, this might be determining my path into, you know, a fortunate or unfortunate human or animal or spirit world birth of many different kinds. But the general idea is that actions done with intention that impact others will be felt, that they really create the states of mind and heart that we then go forward in our life with, that we live with going on from here. The Buddha also weaves into the complexity of karma the way that intentions and then the corresponding consequences of actions can be mixed. And so there's a text that says, you know, that uses the terms that may be inappropriately charged with racial politics now, but uses the terms bright and dark for karma with positive results and karma with negative results, and says that there are actions that have only bright results. There are actions that have only dark results. There are actions that have mixed bright and dark results. And then there are actions that have neither bright nor dark results. And those are the ones that lead toward liberation. So there's actions that are wholesome, essentially, that lead to wholesome outcomes. So when I am generous, kind, truthful, helpful, in service, I do things that are wholesome. They give rise to wholesome states of mind, wholesome emotions. I'm happy I did it. I feel metta, I feel mudita, I feel joy, I feel compassionate. My mind is at ease. And those states of mind will make my future better. You know, if I practice being generous, greed diminishes. And that just makes your life better later on, right? And so you can think of the entire path as a path of shifting our actions from the unwholesome to the wholesome, and therefore accumulating a kind of momentum, and this is really karmic momentum, of goodness that is going to bear fruit. And it bears fruit later on in this life, and further out from there. So karmic actions are ethically charged, they are relational, they are intimately connected with the intentions or the mind state, the state of the mind and heart that we're in when we do actions. And they are mixed. They can be mixed. Intentions can be mixed. That's okay. It's true. It's just true. It's how it is. And the one other thing that we might weave in here is that our own actions are always in a complex systems relationship with the general conditions. So there's all the conditions of the world, some of which we are really conscious of, you know, big systemic conditions like capitalism or patriarchy or, you know, racism, or bigger systemic conditions like being human or being in a, you know, technological world or a post, you know, industrial world, you know, or being omnivorous animals, or being, like relationally oriented animals. All of these are conditions that we can trace to something, trace them to being the species we are, or the culture that we are, or the kind of community that we are, or the kind of families we come from, or the kind of bodies we have. All of these conditions affect our experience moment to moment, right? So my experience in this moment is, in a certain way, the sum total, in a kind of non-quantifiable way, of everything that has ever happened in the past. All of these words, I didn't create the words, I didn't even create most of these thoughts, I'm just telling you what I read and have been taught. So this entire speaking that I'm doing, and the listening that you're doing, and all of the cognitive and emotional and interpersonal energy flying around as we do this complex thing of talking together, all of that carries the karmic momentum of our cultures and of this language and of, you know, so many layers. And you can deconstruct any layer, right? You can pull on any little thread of this thing, and you get you know, endless you know, reams of content, right? Pull on any word in this entire, you know, conversation, and you could pull out the thread of post-colonialism. You could pull out the thread of English grammar. You could pull out the thread of modernist, you know, ethical philosophy. You could pull out the thread of a million things, right? And part of what we do with each other is we choose which threads to emphasize, right? I could teach overtly from the position of being, you know, a mixed race adoptee. And sometimes I choose to do that. I'm like, I'm going to pull on that thread because I have the sense that, like, maybe that's going to be helpful. And other times I'm just going to pull on the thread of being someone who quotes the Pali Canon and, you know, tries to understand how that might be helpful for my life. That's a totally different thread, you know? And sometimes I pull on the thread of being a musician. And so karma is a way of saying that we are vastly, infinitely interconnected to, you know, the whole cosmos. And there are these gorgeous Buddhist images from the ancient world that reflect on this. One of the ones that's really gorgeous and popular because of it is the image of the net of Indra. This is an image of the cosmos being composed of a kind of net or interwoven fabric, where at every intersection of the threads, there's a shimmering gem, like a perfect drop of water. And the whole thing is luminous. It's illuminated by consciousness. And so in the light of awareness or consciousness, divine consciousness, however you want to think about the light that illuminates the cosmos, every drop, as drops of water do, reflects every other drop. So any thread you pull on, you could follow it to any other thread, right? The whole matrix is connected. In ultimately, this is a proposal from Buddhist metaphysics, ultimately in a benevolent way. And this is one of the challenges in Buddhist philosophy that is different from modernist materialist philosophy, the Buddhist worldview does propose that the warp and weft of the cosmos has a layer of meaning in it, and that meaning is ethical, and it has meaning in it because our actions affect others. So the way that the precepts are relational is not just a feature of human existence, but it's actually how action works for every kind of sentient being who does actions. Because everything is connected, actions that impact others, that's real. There's a kind of fundamental reality to that. And so the realness of impact becomes, in a way, the ethical structure of the whole cosmos. So behind all of the cosmological visions in the Buddhist world is this vision of the universe as an ethical engine. And so the thing that matters is how we impact others. So karma speaks about actions that have impact, actions that arise as a result of all the conditions of the past that have come into this moment. They ride on intention. And then here's the last difficult piece. If everything has the characteristic of not having a self, like there's no separate individual, you are not your own individual little knot on Indra's web, and that's just you in some kind of eternal way. Even the sense that that's you is a conditioned phenomenon based on all the conditions. So everything has the characteristic of selflessness. And even the thoughts and feelings I have and the intentions that I have in this moment, where do those intentions come from? I have the intention to try to speak clearly about karma. Where did that intention come from, right? Partly it came from how I learned to speak about Dharma from my teachers. Partly it comes from my desires to be helpful. I could name dozens of conditions that I could say where that intention arose from. If all of those conditions are impersonal, how do I think of that intention as being somehow myself or my own or free? And I'm not going to go into free will as a thing because it's not really a Buddhist conversation. Free will was a Christian conversation that was based on an argument around determinism. Whether or not our actions are fully determined, do your actions actually have an impact in determining whether you are saved or not in the Christian cosmos? There's a version of that in the Buddhist world, but it's not quite the same. So I'm not going to use free will as the thing to talk about, but I want to talk about the mystery of intention. When you have an intention to act a certain way, where does that come from? Because if it did not exist, right? If conditions just automatically led to the next action, it would not be possible to become liberated. There were some Buddhist sects who went all in on this non-dual interdependence thing, and the natural conclusion that those sects came to was that it will inevitably become a Buddha eventually. And maybe you can see how the logic would get there. If conditions create intentions and intentions create actions, and the universe is fundamentally oriented toward liberation, then there must be this selfless unfolding of actions toward liberation that everyone is subject to. But that was not the early Buddhist framework. It was clear to the Buddha that we people, beings, human and spirit and animal and otherwise, we could choose to practice or we could choose not to practice. And the choice to practice mostly, at least for a good while, comes down to being able to choose actions that go against our reactive habits go against the habits that lead to unwholesomeness. And it's really like, how do you choose good? How do you choose to act with goodness over acting with evil, even when evil is often easier, seems easier, and maybe even seems more pleasurable? It seems more pleasurable to complain about how awful that person is than to give rise to a kind of impartial, compassionate, you know, love toward them. There are some terrible people that are hard to love, and it's just easier to hate them. And so why would you choose the path of the Dharma that says go against that urge? Because you know where it leads. You know that cultivating hatred leads to not wellness in your own future, and depending on how you act on that hatred, not wellness in others either. So for the entire system to work, intention has to be an actual choice. There has to be a choice point in there where in the present moment, responding or feeling the momentum from the past, we are able to make a choice. And that choice is always going to be something on the spectrum of can I be more good, or am I lapsing toward less good? Can I practice toward clarity of heart, openness, continuity of presence, or am I going to give in to the long, you know, the long trauma history that pushes on me from past conditions? And so I think this is the most mysterious proposal in the teaching on karma, is that it's not deterministic, that there's actually a lever in there, and the whole discipline of the path relies on this lever, that moment to moment, you actually have to, not only you can, but you must choose how to act, you know? And you would do this because you've seen something about how karma works. You get that wholesome action, wholesome intention, and wholesome action gives rise to a more positive future, a more pleasurable, a more free, a more easeful future for yourself and others. So that's the general framework then. That's the theory of karma broadly. What we can think about then is, we've been talking for some weeks about how do we hold ideas or metaphors or theories about rebirth. And at the heart of the conversation about rebirth is a question that's really a karma question, which is how do individuals experience the results of their own actions? And I was thinking about it in the writing today, thinking about a kind of position that I see relatively common, and I think coming more and more into philosophical focus in some contemporary Buddhist communities, which is something like letting go of ideas of literal rebirth, for sure, and holding on to rebirth as a kind of metaphor for our actions being resonant in the collective sphere. So I do actions that affect the world. They radiate outwards from me into my communities, you know, certainly in the form of my kid. Like, that's a very concrete action that will hopefully outlive me and could well, you know, continue for a very long time, you know, making new karma. But lots of things that I do, like talking with you in this way, sitting in the teacher seat and, you know, pushing the lineage forward in another generation. There are actions that I can do that can outlive me. I can think about that as the primary results of karma. And then I don't have to get into wrestling with rebirth. I can just think about myself present in the collective. So this becomes a compromise position between the materialist position that everything just stops at death, which the Buddha, I think, which the for in a Buddhist perspective is a kind of nihilism because it denies that actions have an effect. A lot of the pushback that I got when I called materialism nihilism a couple weeks ago was mostly, I think, from folks who felt like that was not accurate to the subtlety of contemporary humanist and materialist views. And I think that's appropriate, you know. We do feel like our actions have an impact. But I don't know what that impact is for me individually, right? The ancient problem of evil, which is called theodicy, was a philosophical puzzle, and this was a Christian problem, but it resonates enough with the karmic problem to maybe be useful. It was the problem of how do we think about the results of good and evil action? Why do evil people sometimes live a long, comfortable life? They don't seem to experience, justice for all of their evil actions. And why do sometimes very good people just have a shit time of it and don't seem to get any of the benefit of their good actions? And so, in a certain way, ideas of heaven and hell are one solution to that problem. And Buddhist ideas of heavens and hells and favorable or unfavorable rebirths are, in a way, a similar solution to the problem. And so, do we get away from that kind of overly literal, maybe medieval solution if we take up the idea that the effects of actions are really something that lives in the collective sphere? So I think that's a possible way out of the problem. Part of the challenge there is that the teachings on karma really function on the Dharma path as a tool for motivation. It's hard to convince people to do good. And so, in both the Christian and the, medieval Buddhist, we might say, style, one of the ways to convince people to do good is to threaten them with hell. And, and Buddhism did that as well. I think it did it a little bit more generously because hell is not permanent, so you can always recover from it. I think that's just a little more humane than the idea of permanence. But it was still a threat, And the core equation in, keeping the precepts in the early texts, it really is focused on the individual. There's not a lot of focus on the effect of my actions on the collective outside myself. It's really, if you act in a certain way, you can expect a beneficial rebirth or, a positive experience in the future. If you act other ways, you can expect a more painful one for yourself. And so I think partly, we can do this interesting compromise of transferring karmic result from the individual to the collective. We can partly do this because we live in democracies, most of us, even flawed ones. We've grown up with the idea that our actions can have an effect in the external. The Buddha didn't live in that kind of a political system. There were no activists, as far as we can tell, reported in the Pali Canon, who were trying to change the monarchy to a better form of government. It didn't exist. There was no one recorded trying to change the caste system to be a better system. The Buddha changed the caste system within his own community, but he was, even back in his day, criticized, not quite in his day, but within the first 1,000 years after him, as the Mahayana really got going, there was some criticism of the Buddha for, instead of bringing his critique of the caste system into the larger public square, he just created an intentional community that where caste didn't matter. So he separated from the culture rather than trying to engage with it. He engaged with it in other ways, which we like to emphasize now. But he didn't in some ways that really would be, you know, valorized in the contemporary mind. And so I wonder if partly we can have a vision of karma being primarily collective because we live in societies where collective identity and collective action and collective activism are much more potent forces and places for karmic action that has consequences, than they were in the Buddha's time. And so we're left making this, you know, metaphorical leap from the way karma, the way action and its consequences are described in the early texts as primarily individual, and therefore demanding something of a continuity of the individual beyond one lifetime, into really a quite a different vision of action, which is really going to end up meaning a different vision of the self. And I think we see this in identity, politics, and social structures right now, where one's identity in many ways is much more tied into one's membership in social structures than perhaps in other times and places, or at least it's quite strong now. So where once upon a time I might have only said, I'm, you know, Californian, now I have a list of 20 identity markers to name. And each one of those connects me to a community and a body of discourse and a kind of identity. And if I want to be seen authentically in my identities, I'm going to have to name a whole bunch of those, right? I'm going to have to be visible in a certain way as a, you know, as a queer mixed race adoptee from, you know, settler colonist backgrounds who were impoverished, who were this and that. I'm going to, again, any of these are little threads in the Indra's web, and you pull on them and it's going to vibrate layers of identity that are going to then spread out into the collective. You know, I'm thinking about Harvey Milk's you know, radical gesture, saying, you know, to all the closeted gay folks, like, just come out, everybody come out. And when you do, you know, mainstream culture will realize that we're everywhere and we're not a strange exotic other, but we're actually just, you know, people all around you. And so the gesture is something like, shift from an individual isolated identity into a collective identity, and that collective identity then is going to create karma that can move forward and actually have an impact in the future. So I'll pause there, and just some time for reflection on, you know, any aspect of this, of course, any questions. But I'm particularly curious about how it sounds, this shift from individual consciousness to collective consciousness as a way to talk about how we can think about our actions having an effect in the future, and maybe the results that has on, you know, on motivation. Like, is that easy to do? Is that difficult to do? What are the effects of making that shift in terms of how we think about action and accountability?